Spend the rest of our time now in God's Word and then prayer at the end here. Let's open our Bibles and returning to our study in the book of 1 Samuel in the 25th chapter. That's where we find ourselves. 1 Samuel, the narrative, historical narrative of the life of David and the kings, and the establishment of the kingdom of Israel. And we find ourselves in this chapter, chapter 25. And it is an interesting chapter, to say the least. We learn about some characters and individuals who play a part in David's life, who come into David's life, and those, of course, are at a time frame as they are in his life. It's when he's in the wilderness wanderings or as on the run, a refugee or fugitive of King Saul, who's still alive, still on the throne, and searching and hunting after David to have him put to death. We just come from chapter 24, the last time we were here, last decade, right? And in chapter 24, David found himself in a situation in En-Gedi, in a cave, able to, at that point, by his own hands, put to death King Saul and take over the crown, but he refused to. And in doing so, he exposes, or in this sense, shows Saul for his sin in his murderous ways, in his selfishness, calls him out, but lays himself in the hands of God, says, this is God's dealings, this is not my dealings to deal with the king and King Saul. So there's an interesting context there, as David shows restraint in that chapter and trust in God, if you remember that. But then you move to chapter 25, and it seems like he's lost it. He's lost that restraint, and it's a little different, though a similar situation, only not a threatening one to David, yet still one that, for some reason, David responds, that he doesn't respond the same way he did in the situation with Saul. So we want to see that in this chapter. I've entitled this, in part of his wilderness wanderings, Vengeance and Forgiveness, or Seeking Revenge or Seeking Forgiveness. And we come to this text. Let's read a couple verses here to start. Chapter 25, verse 1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. This man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So we're introduced to this couple in this place where David moves down from where he had been before. Now, if you recall, in the wilderness, in the time in which he's running or staying hidden and kind of moving about in different places, kind of like a warlord or a local ruler, but not really having his own kingdom or not really having his own city or a realm to rule over. He knows he's going to be king, but he's not yet. And yet he is also the target with all the placards or whatever you want, the stones or papers, wanted David, son of Jesse. If anyone finds him and sees him, report him to King Saul or his soldiers. So he's on the run, and there's that constant life of his for about three and a half years. And he'd been in places, and you've seen pictures, I showed you some pictures of what that looks like in the places he's hiding in a wilderness. It would be a forest of trees, or it'd be over in another part in a desert amongst these ravines and canyons, and wherever it is he can hide out, that's where he is on the run, and yet there's a vast wilderness there for him to find refuge, at least for the time being, until he's found out again. And here is another incidence of that, where he goes down a little further south from where he is into the wilderness of Paran. This would probably be in this area, the city or the region there is Carmel, which would be south of Hebron, and that's in the southern portion of Israel, still kind of to the western side of the Dead Sea, but you're in the wilderness area. You're not in trees and thick forests and lush meadows. You're up in the mountains and the hills and barren, kind of desert-like. So it's a place for flocks. It's a place where they would have sheep and goats in the herds, and that's where the people who had large flocks would find easy access to rangeland or grazing land. And so this is where he takes himself and his group of hundreds of people, really, of about 600 soldiers. And you come to this text in chapter 25, and it's one of those characteristics of the scriptures that I appreciate, the genuine and trustworthy features of the Bible, where it's boldly transparent about the heroes of the Bible. We would say David is a hero. David's one of the guys you look up to. Yet it's honest about him, and it shows the real record. It shows the timeliness of things. It doesn't try to whitewash David or the people in his life. And we've already seen that David is a man of prayer. We've seen he's a man of godly character. He's a man after God's own heart. He writes poetry. He writes psalms. He writes music. He's a musician. He's a warrior. He's also a person who's wise. He has convictions. He has principles by which he lives by. And we've learned that so far. A natural leader and a godly man. One that you would want to be king of Israel. Yet we come in this chapter and something kind of slips with him. There's something that shows a character of his that might be a weakness, or he shows weakness here. And it's a fascinating type of picture into this life, and the Bible, in revealing this, is bluntly honest. And it's good to be that way. It's good to see this is the reality of it. This is how life is. And these are the type of people that God works with and works in the lives of and uses other people. And you see two people in this passage that the Lord, in his providence, by his hand, uses to help David and actually prevent David from committing what would be a terrible error of judgment, a rash judgment of his. And he responds with an anger here that he should have kept under control. And it took these people to come in, these really no names, a woman who's a wife of this man, and then a servant boy to be used by God to confront him and stop him in his tracks and turn his course around to avoid what could be a gross disaster. And that's quite a different picture that you see in this chapter from the chapter before. David's standing in the way of his soldiers from killing Saul and saying, "No, I will not lift my hand up against Saul." But here in chapter 25, with David, his soldiers, himself, he's ready to slay a man over a dishonorable act. And God sends a woman and a slave boy to step in the way and prevent him from doing that. It's quite a picture there. And there's some things we want to draw out from this chapter and see. And there's some character things. There's some lessons to be learned, especially from the woman Abigail and the character she shows in the midst of this. So as we walk through this, I just want to walk through this particular chapter, which is a tiny little portal in the life of David's wanderings and journeys and his whole career. And here's just this moment in time, and God takes it out, brings it to us in a full chapter here of what happens and the interactions and the reactions and the responses that reveal David's heart, but really does reveal God's goodness in the midst of his life. It's a story that ultimately results in showing us who the wife of David would be, Abigail. Now, he was already married to Michal, but Michal stays back in Gibeah as he flees, and Saul took it upon himself to take Michal and give her to another man. So David, probably knowing this, thinking he is no longer married and free, or maybe he doesn't know that. Whatever the case, here is his second wife, Abigail, and where she comes from, and what type of woman she is. So it's a fascinating little scene in the history books of Israel. You're going to see some customs here. You're going to see some shame and honor, which is one of those cultural type of ethics that goes on in the midst of the people that are living in these tents and in these cities. And here's David living some cave somewhere, probably again. And there's a shame and honor rule that is operating in the midst of this. There's issues of marriage that you learn here, and God's providence. Gives us a chance to put ourselves in David's shoes here. So let's take a look. As the first thing we see here is Samuel dies. And who is Samuel? Of course, he's the kingmaker. Samuel is the one who starts up this book, 1 Samuel. And Samuel is the one who anointed Saul to be king. Saul fails. Samuel is disappointed. And he pulls himself away from being kind of a priestly or prophetic advisor to Saul. And he moves away from that. And then God directs Samuel to David, to the house of Jesse, to anoint David to be the next king. So he's the key individual, at least the leader, a judge, the last of the judges of that era. And he has died. His old age, he's dead. All Israel assembles and mourns for him and gives him that due respect. And in the midst of that, David rises up and moves. And he moves down to this area of the wilderness of Paran, and he settles there. He and all his soldiers with him, about, like you said, about 600 of them, plus others, family members and whatnot, that are there with him. So they settle in this area, which is kind of a barren area, more like a pasture land, if anything. Not a lot of people live in this region. So we got to get, first of all, here, let's walk through a little outline as I'll break this little narrative down into you some points. The first one is a historical setting. You got to understand this. And there's a few things that are marked out here that you don't want to miss. If you just kind of read through this, it don't really mean anything until you kind of connect them back to the past history, and there's a certain context that's going on here. So as David rises up and he goes to the wilderness of Paran, we're then introduced in verse 2 to a man who lives down there in Maon, whose business was in Carmel. The man was rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. Of course, how many of his flocks is a measurement of how wealthy the man is. That's where the wealth is measured. This is a man who has some influence, has some slaves and servants, a lot of people working for him, a lot of assets. And he lives in this area. He's an important individual. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. There's a little bit of context right there. It's a time of shearing of sheep, which would probably be once a year. And they would shear the sheep and they would take the wool. And of course, there's the value largely of the sheep would be their wool. And you would make all sorts of garments and whatnot from that. So he's got quite a business and quite an enterprise here. And in this time, as he's shearing his sheep, the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. And then we have a revelation of their character given to us by the writer of 1 Samuel. Abigail is like a stark contrast to Nabal. Abigail is one, he says, that is beautiful and discerning. Discerning comes first there. Nabal, on the other hand, was harsh and badly behaved. And you want to see that proven? Watch and listen to the rest of the story in this chapter. And we'll see what happens here. And here's a test for David, a test for his restraint. He can show restraint towards Saul, but here's this guy, this businessman in this area down in the deserts. Can he have restraint for him if this man and his treatment of David and his servants? So the historical setting takes us there to this place. Nabal is given a little more information about him. He is a Calebite. Calebites are those that are descendants of Caleb. And who is Caleb? One of the 12 spies. All the way back in the book of Numbers with Moses. First generation of Moses coming into the land, send the 12 spies into the land, check out the land, bring back some of its produce. This is what God is going to lead us into. He's going to hand this over to us. We're going to win our battles here. Well, 10 of the spies didn't agree with that. 10 of the spies said, no, there are giants in there. This is scary. We're going to die. We need to turn back to Egypt. But 2 of the spies said, no, 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 no. We're going to believe the Lord. We need to go forward. And the 2 spies, probably the 2 most important individuals post-Moses, Joshua and Caleb. Joshua and Caleb. Godly men, heroes, courageous, theologically sound and fit for the task. Caleb is this man, and these are his tribal allotments down in this region here. He was given land as he was perishing, as he was coming to his older age and given to his family. And there's a scene there in the book of Deuteronomy that shows this. Caleb's a special individual. Well, that doesn't mean all his children are like that. And here's one of his descendants some 400 years later, Nabal, who is certainly not one who got the gene that marked Caleb as a godly and courageous and good man. And it is Nabal. So here he is in this area. Carmel, it says, is where we find him doing business. So he's probably gathered all his flocks, and he's now shearing his flocks in this region of Carmel, which is in this wilderness area, again, south of Hebron, and out in the wilderness, out in the desert regions or pasture land areas. Now, it's important to see this. Carmel has a history. This is the place, if we were to back up to chapter 15, you don't need to go there. Let me just remind you what chapter 15 was. That was the time in which Saul was told by God through Samuel to go and attack the Amalekites and destroy them and leave none of them alive. And what did Saul do? He attacked the Amalekites, he destroyed them, and he brought all the animals, and he spared Agag, their king. He did not obey the Lord entirely. Instead, he did this, and it's also stated there in chapter 15, he built a monument in Carmel, this area right here, for himself, to take credit for what he has done in defeating the Amalekites, a self-boasting monument to his own honor. Saul did that. So that was a recent history thing to this point. And Nabal and the others would be pretty aware of that, and so would David. So here, in this same area here, the issue of Saul and his kingdom, Saul and his history, and now David is in this presence here, comes into play. And this particular small town or small village, whatever it was, has these two kings at the center of it. So there is a bit of a history setting up for us. Now, in the midst of this is the time of the shearing of the sheep. The shearing of the sheep. There's a lot of history here, and now comes this time frame during the year that they shear the sheep. This is a time kind of like when the grapes are harvested, or the olives are harvested, or the dates are harvested, or the wheat is harvested, or the barley's harvested, the sheep are sheared, and whatever. It's that time which finally the year's worth of work comes to fruition. You gather in the harvest, and it's a time of celebration. It's a time where the real wealth comes out of the people, and they bring in the harvest, and they bring in their money in this way. This is an annual custom. So, second point, verse 4. So David comes at this time during this annual custom of shearing the sheep and celebrating it. It says in verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time that they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants, to your son David. Now that might sound preposterous. That might sound a little impulsive or presumptuous of David to do this, that he's coming and asking this wealthy man, give us some of your harvest. Give us what you got on hand. Feed us. Provide for us in some way. He may be asking that, and it comes as a request. Asking requests, but really what's happening here is custom. This is a customary thing. Being the local warlord now, as David is, he's got an army. Living in this area, he's kind of this strong man of the area, or a ruler in a way, and those who have flocks would benefit by these warlords or these rulers with armies in this area. They'd benefit because they would protect their flocks from invading raiders through the year, however long they're there. So David had done that. And as they live there and they see these flocks, they protected these people's allotments and these people's possessions and their property from what would be thieves. And so there was a benefit that was given to Nabal, especially to his servants, as all of them were cared for and all of them wouldn't need to worry about raiders or thieves or whatever there may be. We've got already an army here protecting us like a wall is what they would describe this. So there's something of that that is taking place at this time. And if they did that, what happens during the harvest would be the one who owns all this stuff would make note of that and, of course, provide or give what would be a payment to those who help benefit and the productivity of the flock or the productivity of the farm or whatnot, and they would pay out to those who served. Walter Chantry says it this way, "Sheep shearing is much like harvest time. It's a season of hard work followed by celebration. Then notice taken of the annual increase of flocks and profits from wool are calculated. Owners of flocks would send gifts to the poor and to those whose services advanced their prosperity." That's where David falls in. "Any local ruler or strongman would send greetings to the farmer at shearing time and courteously remind him of protection provided to his herdsmen throughout the year." And that's what David is appealing to here. It's customary. This is not something that is presumptuous of David to do at all. He had protected the flocks. The issue is, would Nabal respond and give him what he's asking for and provide him what he deserves, what his men deserved as they protected? They benefited by this protection. Now, this is not like the mob, where the mob comes to a business down in Brooklyn or whatever and says, "Hey, you need to pay for protection. Because we're here, we protect you from bad guys and thieves and robbers from robbing your business. If you don't pay us off, you're going to be exposed to that." And what they're really doing is, you need to pay us to protect you from us. Because if you don't, we'll come in and mess you up. So that's extortion. That's not extortion that's going on here. He actually did protect their flocks. He was there living amongst them, and raiders and invaders, and in even some cases, as we've already seen, and we will see later in this book, where there were invaders and Philistines and other peoples that would come in and attack cities, he would go and fight those battles for them and defeat the enemies and throw them out and restore the cities to Israel. So there is a benefit for these strongmen to be in the area. And of course, the ones who own the enterprise, the rich and the wealthy and the ones who own the flocks, would want to be sure that they pay them and care for them and provide for them to show their appreciation. That's all that's happening here. That's all that David is asking. And so he goes and sends his men. And in verse, what do we have here? The next verse, "When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?' So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, 'Every man strap on his sword.' Every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage." 400 plus one are ready for battle. That little incident of dishonor, of disrespect, spurred up a fury in David. "I'm not going to let this guy get away with this. I'm going to restore my honor, my public honor, and I'm going to wipe this guy out." If you jump ahead a few verses, up to verse 21. "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.'" That was David's intention at this point. But what stirred this was this railing insult. It's insulting. It was a rude, disrespectful reception. Who is David? It's not that he didn't know David. He knew who David was. There's a monument here to Saul. Everybody in Israel knows all about what's going on here, that Saul is hunting David, and everybody's required to tell Saul where David is. There's already been an incident in nearby cities, not very far from this point, that led to him escaping to En-Gedi. You remember where he's running on one side of the hill and Saul's army's on the other side? That happened not very far from here. So this is not a statement of ignorance. This is just a statement of dishonor and disrespect and rudeness. Nabal, of course, is acting by his character, as you see that, harsh and badly behaved. This is Nabal. This is what we get. Just a railing insult. David responds in flaring up in anger. He's ready in this instant to go down and slay everybody in this house. Now, there's a comparison here. This is David reacting. If you go back not too many chapters, remember Saul's reaction when he heard the priests at Nob had received David and they gave him Goliath's sword. Remember that scene? And so the priests at Nob were helping David, but they weren't really in on the issue that David was fleeing from Saul yet. Saul heard about that, called them in, found out what they had done, and had them slayed, and then one guy went out and slayed the whole city of Nob. That was the type of rash fury that Saul had. Here is David about to do the same thing. So we have to see, there's a comparison going on between David and Saul. We want to be watchful of this. David isn't pure in every way. There's issues here where he is rash and responding wrongly. He should take the advice that we see from Scripture. Romans chapter 12 tells us of this. The advice he's going to hear from Abigail in a moment. Romans 12 verse 17 says these words for us. Repay no one evil for evil. Remember what David just said? He's repaid evil for my good. He's going to get his now. He's going to repay evil for evil. But God says, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves. What is David doing here? I'm avenging my dishonor. This is a shame-honor culture here. He has shamed me publicly before these young men I sent and before his own household. I'm going to get mine. But here is what he should do. Leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you'll heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So what should have David done? Should have done good. He should have sent a delegation of food to Nabal. That would be a good sign of his understanding of this issue. And so here is David in the midst of this, but he's reacting with his passions, with his hurt feelings, if you want to say it that way. He has been dishonored. He's been disrespected. He has been rudely treated, insulted, and he's ready to respond. Now, David doesn't mean David's an evil individual. This is a human. This is a man who needs help at times and more often than not, just as the rest of us. There's a number of examples, by the way, in the Bible of signs like this where you see these strong heroes or faithful individuals who at a time show a glaring weakness and just seem like, what happened to them? They were this way that day, and the next day they're here. David here showing this. Moses, remember Moses? Let me take you back there. Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. You know about Moses' character in 12:3. The scriptures tell us about this. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. There's a description of the character of Moses, a meek man. That is a humble man. Person who's not thinking too highly of himself, one who is respectful of others, one who is not pushing his agenda ahead of others. He was a meek man. But about eight chapters later, in chapter 20, this meek man, in response at the waters of Meribah, as the people once again complaining to the Lord, and he goes to the Lord, and the Lord said, "Speak to the rock." And what does Moses do? The Lord said, "Take the staff, assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle." And Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. This is chapter 20 of Numbers. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels. Shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff. And water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." And so you see this rash, angry response from Moses, just not character of him to do that, yet here he did it. You remember Elijah? Elijah on the Mount Carmel. This is a different Carmel than this one here in Samuel. It's to the north. He gathers King Ahab and all the prophets of Asherah, all the prophets of Baal, and bring them on, me against them. And it's a battle now. Whose God is the true God? And you remember that great scene in 1 Kings 17. And there's this battle between the prophets. And the winner is, of course, Elijah, because he is the prophet of the true God, and they are the false gods. And what does Elijah do at that moment? He has all of them slain. Take them all out. Slay them all. Get rid of them. And then he prays to God, and the rain comes and sends Ahab back. But then it wasn't very long after that great courageous scene that Elijah hears that Jezebel heard. And Jezebel said, "So long," I don't remember the exact words, but "so long as whatever, if you're not dead, by the time I get my hands on you, so be it. It happened to me." She's threatening, and she's ready to take out Elijah. And what is Elijah's response? "Run for the hills. I'm scared to death of this lady." And he takes off. So it's just kind of an odd picture there. But this is the people of God. This is human. Weakness at times, strength at other times. Peter was the same, ready to slay all those who'd come into the Garden of Gethsemane to arrest Jesus. And within hours, he is melting into the crowds as a coward, denying the Lord three times. So there's much to be learned about that, about the character of man. And here's David as an example of that. He looks great in chapter 24. Here in chapter 25, he's ready to commit what would be a genocide upon a family, all because of an offense that this man had spoken to his young men. And that's something to be considerate of and watchful of. And the Lord will step in. Actually, the Lord sends a way to protect him from doing that here. And here's how it turns out. Verse 14, we'll look at the urgent appeal. The urgent appeal. After the insult, and in verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, we don't know who this guy is, no name, just a normal dude. And the Lord picks normal dudes and brings them in and uses them to prevent this man from committing this atrocity of a sin. He says, "But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all this house or his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him. This young man makes an appeal. He doesn't go to Nabal because no one can speak to Nabal. Nabal will not listen. So he knows who he can go to. He goes to his wife, Abigail, because she is of a different character. And he speaks to her and appeals to her and says, listen, we're in a deep trouble right now. The innocent are going to be slaughtered due to this man's actions here. And this is the reason why, and he explains the whole scene to her. And this is the appeal. And his actions will nearly cost the lives of all the males in the household, and that would probably include this young man. So he steps up, says something, and God uses that conversation and that warning to stir Abigail, who then, which we'll call here the godly intervention, she steps up and she intervenes. In verse 18, then Abigail made haste, took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, 3 seahs of parched grain, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on donkeys. So she's got a whole set of donkeys. She's got the full semi-truck of food heading their way out in the wilderness. She knows what needs to happen. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Obviously, she could not. But this is an interesting. Here's this wife, this woman. She's not cowering here. She's stepping up to make a decision, the right decision, and doing so in the right way. And she really just ignores her husband at this point and goes right to David and sends everything to David. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by this morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. Notice that. He made an oath. He made an oath here. I am going to do this. May God do the enemies of Israel what I'm going to do here. And then when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey, fell before David on her face, bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, oh, me, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears. Hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal, by the way, means fool. Nabal is his name. Folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from serving or saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to me, to my Lord, be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause, now notice this, of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord taking vengeance himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. That is great. I don't know what you call that. Defense? Intervention? Call that an intervention. That's a godly intervention. This woman's thinking. This woman is theological. This woman is courageous. She steps out in humility. She steps forward, ready to speak to this one king to be, David, not afraid, moves in here because people's lives are on the line. And she speaks, and she stands in the gap to protect those whose lives are being threatened by this very one, David. She doesn't know how she's going to be received, so she comes in this type of manner. Abigail turns out to be the hero in this narrative, saving multiple lives, covering a multitude of sins, like James 5:20 talks about. You can say the same thing of the young man who spoke to Abigail. So you have those two together are the heroes in this text. It's not David. David actually is the one who could have caused great harm. But God used these ones to then redirect David's heart, redirect his actions, and to check him in his pursuit, which would have been a sinful pursuit of vengeance, seeking vengeance of his own. So Abigail here stopping him from shedding blood, reminding him that the Lord will fight his battles. You see that? The Lord's going to be the one who'll fight your battles. Let him be the one. She admits her own guilt because David was right to take offense, and her guilt on this was to not take notice that the young man had come. Well, we would really say the real guilt belongs to Nabal. She shows the way of seeking forgiveness. She shows the way of making peace. She humbles herself. She makes no demands of David. She admits that guilt. She admits that infraction, if we could say that, because David is here, and David is acting on something that was a dishonorable thing. She makes restitution. She gives a large gift, even more so than her husband was even asked to give. She restored David's honor publicly here, and she asked for forgiveness. And here is this picture for David to learn from, by the way. It's not David and his character is being drawn out to act in some way. He's the one now needs to be stopped. He's the one needs to be stopped in his tracks like Saul needed to be stopped in his tracks in the chapter before. So how does David respond? Well, we'll call this a reprovable ego. I'm not even sure if that's a word, but we'll say it anyways. Reprovable ego. David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself from my own hand. For surely, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." You know, we need people like that in our lives to step in there and keep us from making really bad choices, really bad decisions that could result in harm, result in things that we, in our conscience, would realize, wow, I wish I'd have gotten some counsel on that. I wish I would have made the right choice then. God brings people in, and God brings those people in at the right time to check us and to turn us aside, to guide us away from what would be foolish decisions. So here's David's ego that is checked, and he humbles himself. He doesn't let his ego get in the way. And he determines instead that he's not going to follow through with his oath. Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." You know, it's all right not to follow through with that oath. They said, so long as this, this, and this, I'm going to make sure this happens. You know, if that's a rash decision, it's better to just back off and say, nope, I'd rather be the one, the fool here, rather than commit the sin that would be the end result of that. See, greatness is not in the appearance of sinlessness, but rather in the genuine openness which owns your own sin. That you own that sin. I'm not going to sin here. I have responded wrongly, and turns around and does the right thing instead. That's what happens with David. That shows some humility on David's part, and that's good. It shows his moldable heart, open to rebuke, even from this woman he'd not known before, not associated with him. His ego was not ultimately what rules David like it did Saul. Ultimately, it is, I want to honor God, I want to do the right thing. And may God be the one who fights my battles. That's the end that he needed to learn. Vengeance is not David's, it is God's to take. And he is to return that evil. He should have returned good for it. And here's the good he turns around. I will not do this. I'll grant you this petition, and I'll leave you alone, and we'll go from there. Well, there's the last scene here, and God does take up the fight for him. This dishonor on the part of Nabal, God takes note of it and moves towards Nabal's destruction. Verse 36, we'll call this the returning of evil. Who returns evil? Evil for evil? It is God who brings the vengeance. And watch how it happens. And Abigail came to Nabal. Behold, he was holding a feast in his home, like the feast of a king, and Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. That's happened to a few people in the Bible before, hasn't it? I don't know what happened here. Some say, well, my notes here say he probably had a stroke and paralyzed, and for the next 10 days, he would be in that condition until finally he died. Whatever happened, the Lord struck him. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal." He learned a lesson. It's the Lord who has avenged this. He's kept back his servant from wrongdoing. He kept me from seeking revenge. Left it in God's hands. He took it from me in that way. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head. Then David said and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel. Both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was in Galim. So we have a little statement about the marital status of David. He is a polygamist, if you note that. You don't want to make note of this and say, all right, this is what we need, this is what we want, this is really good. That's not necessarily the blessing of God for him to take multiple wives. In this particular case, we have Abigail coming in. But you can look at this and say, Abigail looks at David and sees David in his honor. David looks at Abigail and sees that she is one of discretion, one of theology, one of good character, and he chooses her to be a wife. There's some good qualities there to look at. Again, Walter Chantry says, "Their mutual attraction was in nobility of character that they found in one another. For years, Abigail had lived with an insolent, drunken, and evil-tongued rogue. In David, she saw a man who served the Lord, who was approachable and guileless. David was drawn to a woman of grace and wisdom as well as an uncommon beauty, but both understanding how to confess guilt and how to grant pardon. These are the important traits for making any marriage successful. Nonetheless, such a rationale should not override the commands of God." God doesn't condone polygamy, is what we'll say to conclude that. So this is a great chapter, interesting chapter in the life of David. And how it kind of intertwines with what we've seen with Saul and how God is dealing with Saul and the character of Saul and the character of David and how the Lord works, and he's trying to mold and develop this man's heart and develop him into the godly man he's to be to rule the nation of Israel. This is not a chapter about David falling in love with a beautiful Abigail, a romantic tale. That's not what this chapter is about. Kind of shows up there at the end, but that's not really what it's about. It's about revenge and forgiveness and trusting in the providence of God. It's about doing the right thing, even if it means canceling out that oath and kind of looking stupid and embarrassed about it. Or stopping in your tracks from doing something you hadn't thought through thoroughly. It's about quickly confessing sin, trusting God to fight your battles, rather than taking vengeance in your own hand. It's a lesson David learns. He could have learned that from Saul. He let whatever passion was there, whatever fight was in his own heart to take things in his own hands, and he had to have God step in and stop him from doing that and restrain him from doing that. And we should pray, God, restrain us from sin. Restrain us from acting foolishly, making choices that result in the harm and the hurt and the pain that is unnecessary. We should pray the same thing. Let's close in prayer. Lord, I do thank you for these lessons. Thank you for the story of David, a real man, and real people are here, and lives are affected by choices that he makes. These are lessons we can learn from, Lord, and I do pray that you would send to us, as often as you see fit, those who would step in, stand in the way to restrain us from foolish decisions, or restrain us from some sin, restrain our flesh, our sinful passions from getting the upper hand, and people who will remind us of your sovereign care for us, your goodness towards us, that you will fight our battles, that we need not take vengeance in our own hands, but you are the one who is responsible for that, that we to trust in those things. Help us, Lord, to learn this. Thank you for these friends. Thank you for these people that you send in our life. And we thank you that you'll continue to do so because it is to the best interest of all of us, to the benefit of all of us, that we receive such reproof, such correction, such love, such care, and such honor. And you, Lord, do this in our lives every day. May we be responsive to that. And may you bless these words to our heart. We thank you as we pray in Christ's name. Amen.